This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
And the policy focus in the nation's capital has been on COVID, a federal COVID relief plan, how much and where the money should be targeted, the first COVID vaccines to be approved and used here and in Great Britain, and how liability for the vaccine should be limited. Good evening, and thanks for joining us on this, the 8th of December, for Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm your host, Peter Slen. Deaths from COVID-19 in the U.S. are averaging 2,200 a day, matching the peak of last April. And cases per day are at about 200,000. Now, according to the Associated Press, the United States passed 15 million cases today, and virtually every state is reporting surges just as a vaccine appears days away from getting the go-ahead in the U.S. Also today, the Congress has been working on a general federal spending bill to keep the government operating, and there's been pushback against President-elect Biden's choice for Secretary of Defense. And in other news, the Army fired or suspended 14 officers and enlisted soldiers at Fort Hood, Texas, and ordered policy changes to address leadership failures at the base. More on that later in the program. We'll start tonight with COVID and Operation Warp Speed. The first of the vaccines were injected today in Great Britain, which has granted emergency authorization to Pfizer, and the U.S. could follow suit by the end of the week. And President Trump signed an executive order in which the Secretary of Health and Human Services is directed to ensure that Americans have priority access to the vaccine. Here's the president at today's Operation Warp Speed Task Force event at the White House.
So now I want to ask several leaders who have been crucial in this effort to join me on stage as I sign the executive order to ensure that American citizens have first priority to receive American vaccines. And then we're going to be working with other countries all over the world. And I think we'll be able to start doing that almost immediately also, because we have millions of doses coming in. So thank you very much. Thank you. It's a great honor.
And that was the president earlier today at the White House. After he signed that executive order, he took some questions from reporters about his guidance to Americans for staying healthy during the holiday season. Here is one of those exchanges.
I'm wondering, though, what your message is to the American people, given all of the increasing cases right now, about what they should do over Christmas and the hardship that they're all facing as this virus does get worse.
Yeah, well, CDC puts out their guidelines, and they're very important guidelines. But I think that the vaccine was our goal. That was number one, because that was the way it ends. Plus, you do have an immunity. You develop immunity over a period of time. And I hear we're close to 15%. I'm hearing that. And that is terrific. That's a very powerful vaccine in itself. And just tremendous progress has been made. One of the reasons we do show so many, and I say this and I've been saying it for a long time, so many cases is because of the fact that we have 200 million tests. And you take, I think India is actually in second place with just a fraction of that number. So we're many times greater than the second country. And India has 1.4 billion people, where our testing program has been incredible. And we actually are also coming out with new tests very shortly that will make the process even easier. And you won't need doctors necessarily to do the test. So we have some incredible tests coming out in a very short period of time. Yeah, please.
Some of these scientific officials here in this room have encouraged Americans not to travel this holiday season, not to go to large gatherings. Across the street, you've been holding holiday parties with hundreds of people, many not wearing masks. Why are you modeling a different behavior to the American people than what your scientists tell?
Well, they're Christmas parties, and frankly, we've reduced the number very substantially, as you know. And I see a lot of people at the parties wearing masks. I mean, I would say that I look out at the audience at those parties, and we have a lot of people wearing masks, and I think that's a good thing.
And that was President Trump earlier today. And across the Atlantic, 90-year-old Margaret Keenan was the first UK citizen to be administered the COVID-19 vaccine. According to the Guardian newspaper, quote, Keenan, a retired shop clerk from Northern Ireland who celebrates her birthday next week, was at the front of the line at University Hospital Coventry to receive the vaccine that was approved by British regulators last week. The UK is the first Western country to deliver a broadly tested and independently reviewed vaccine to the general public. The COVID-19 shot was developed by U.S. drug maker Pfizer and Germany's BioNTech, end quote. Now here's British Prime Minister Boris Johnson in a public service announcement released this afternoon from 10 Downing Street.
Hi folks, I'm here at Guy's and St Thomas's Hospital in London, and it's just been incredible to see the very first clinically approved vaccine going into the arms of patients here in London, as is happening across the whole of the UK at the moment. And as you know, we've got about 40 million doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine coming into this country. But the key thing is that although this is a massive, massive moment, it's not the end. People cannot afford to relax their discipline, stop doing the basics, hands, face, space, because if you look at what's happening in London, for instance, you are seeing that disease starting to climb again in spite of all the efforts that we've made. Absolutely vital, therefore, we keep discipline, keep formation as we roll out the vaccine at the same time.
And that was British Prime Minister Boris Johnson earlier today. Authorities in the UK noted that the vaccination campaign would take many months. The United Kingdom has seen over 61,000 deaths in the pandemic, more than any other country in Europe, and has recorded more than 1.7 million confirmed cases. Now in Wilmington, Delaware today, President-elect Joe Biden pledged to, quote, change the course, end quote, of the coronavirus pandemic as he introduced members of his healthcare team. The president-elect laid out his plan for combating the virus during the first 100 days of his administration. Here's a portion of his remarks from earlier today in Wilmington.
My first 100 days won't end the COVID-19 virus. I can't promise that. But we did not get into this mess quickly. We're not going to get out of it quickly. It's going to take some time. But I'm absolutely convinced that in 100 days, we can change the course of the disease and change life in America for the better. First, my first 100 days is going to require, I'm going to ask for a masking plan. Everyone for the first 100 days of my administration to wear a mask. It will start with my signing an order on day one to require masks where I can under the law, like federal buildings, interstate travel on planes, trains, and buses. I'll also be working with the governors and mayors to do the same in their states and their cities. We're going to require masks wherever possible. But this goes beyond government action. And so, as a new president, I'm going to speak directly to the American people and say what I'm saying now. We need your help. Wear a mask for just 100 days. It's the easiest thing you can do to reduce COVID cases, hospitalizations, and death. Help yourself, your family, and your community. Whatever your politics or point of view, mask up for 100 days once we take office. 100 days to make a difference. It's not a political statement. It's a patriotic act. It won't be the end of our efforts, but it's a necessary and easy beginning, an easy start. Secondly, This team will help get at the last 100 million COVID-19 vaccine, at least 100 million COVID vaccine shots into the arms of the American people in the first 100 days. 100 million shots in the first 100 days. And we'll follow the guidance of science to get the vaccines to those most at risk. That includes healthcare professionals, people in long-term care, and as soon as possible, it will include educators. This will be the most efficient mass vaccination plan in U.S. history.
And that was President-elect Biden earlier today in Wilmington. Here on Washington Today, we also talked with Dan Diamond of Politico about COVID-19 and getting an update for from today. We begin by asking him if the FDA will authorize a vaccine here in the States.
So if the FDA goes ahead with this emergency authorization, there is a very good chance that by the beginning of next week, people will start getting shots in arms, perhaps even earlier. There are distribution chains that have been set up, planes that are standing by to distribute the vaccine. I was speaking earlier today on Tuesday with Congressman Fred Upton of Michigan, who pointed out that there's a factory in Michigan, a production plant in Michigan, that he thinks is going to be distributing and producing some of the vaccine supply. So things could kick into gear fairly quickly. The challenge is that the number of doses is smaller than initially promised. We may only see tens of millions of people, 10 million people, get the Pfizer dose within the next number of weeks, as opposed to the earlier goal of hundreds of millions of Americans within the next couple of weeks getting dosage. So there will be some shots in arms, I would bet, within the next week. But how many people are getting those shots? A relatively small number, and smaller than we first thought.
Why did we see shots being given in the UK today?
Well, that's the question that the White House and President Trump has been asking, not just today when the UK started administering those shots, but has been asking why the UK has been a little bit ahead of the United States. So the United Kingdom has already authorized the vaccine, the Pfizer vaccine, and they did that with somewhat less data publicly available. But the belief was, at least in the UK, that given the crisis, the pandemic, and their review team, they felt they had enough evidence to go ahead and make the vaccine available. There's another country too, Bahrain, in the Middle East, that went ahead and authorized the vaccine as well. So even though President Trump talks a lot about being America first, leading the world in our fight against COVID, which, by the way, we most certainly are not. We've had a terrible go of it. But even on the vaccine front, where we took so much pride as a nation in the Operational Warp Speed Initiative and even helped stake Pfizer by guaranteeing that the vaccine would have a market here, the U.S. is not going to be first out of the gate, and that really has rankled senior officials.
And Dan Diamond, speaking of hesitancy to accept the virus, I think I saw a poll that 42% of the American population was hesitant or would not take the virus or would not take the vaccine.
Yes, I've seen, Peter, poll numbers that are similar to that, maybe a little bit lower, a little bit higher. But vaccine hesitancy is very much what FDA officials have been trying to stave off. You asked about the difference between the UK, which moved quicker, and the U.S. FDA officials have said, we want to make sure that we're taking every step possible to build confidence in the vaccine. And if that means we're holding the vaccine authorization process a week later, so we can be that much more confident in the data, and hopefully Americans will be that much more confident in what shots they're getting, then that's a worthy trade. Not everyone agrees with that. But the vaccine hesitancy that has built over the year, partly fueled by the confusing messages that have come from the White House, from President Trump, about coronavirus and the political season that we have just exited with the election campaign, it's depressing to me as a public health reporter, if not totally surprising, that lots of Americans are doubtful about the proclamations around coronavirus treatment.
And Dan Diamond, we started this conversation, you talking about watching a split screen with the Trump administration talking about its efforts with regard to a vaccine and the Biden incoming administration talking about its new health team. What did you learn on that side of the screen?
Well, it was a little confusing to have the two audio streams going at once, but I think in my brain I was able to disentangle them and focus largely on the Biden team when they were speaking. The team that is being unveiled by President-elect Biden, it's most of his health squad. It's not everybody yet, but it's led by his HHS secretary pick, Javier Becerra, who was a longtime congressman before becoming the attorney general of California for the past 4 years. And as the Attorney General of California, he was arguably the biggest legal thorn in the side of the Trump administration. He sued to stop multiple rules and policies. He led the fight to preserve Obamacare, most recently this past year. So he brings that perspective, and some of that came through in the comments that he's made over the past few days about his defense of the Affordable Care Act. But the challenge facing Attorney General Becerra, if he gets the job of HHS Secretary, which is by no means guaranteed, he'll have to navigate a divided Senate, he will be stepping into a major management responsibility despite having relatively little management experience. As a congressman, he's very prominent, but that doesn't mean that he develops the same skills that, say, a governor or a senior administration official running a different part of the government would have had. And what we've seen in covering HHS in recent years, the people who stepped in who had that high-level management experience were able to translate those skills. There was a HHS secretary earlier in the Trump administration, Tom Price, who had been a congressman, and he did have challenges stepping into the role of running this 80,000-person department, and that wasn't during a pandemic. Some of the other folks who spoke at the Biden unveiling included Rochelle Walensky, his pick for CDC director. She would not need Senate confirmation, so that seems like a shoe-in, barring some major surprise. She's a doctor at Massachusetts General, an infectious disease specialist. So her viability in the middle of a pandemic in leading the CDC would be, it would make a lot of sense. The question is, does she have the skill set and the breadth of knowledge when we get past the pandemic to deal with all the other public health issues? And Vivek Murthy, who was Obama's Surgeon General, is set to be Biden's Surgeon General in an unusual return to that role, but he'll have a supersized position, we expect. He's built a very strong bond with Joe Biden, so he'll be very much at the center of things in the next couple months.
Well, Dan Diamond of Politico, thanks for the update on all things COVID-19. You can read Mr. Diamond's writing at politico.com.
Peter, thanks so much for having me back on Washington Today.
And you're listening to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
And welcome back. This is Washington Today for Tuesday, December 8th. I'm your host, Peter Sledd. In other news, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said today that Democrats and Republicans negotiating a coronavirus relief bill should set aside the two most significant partisan demands and reach a deal on the remaining elements. Republicans have said no to Democrats' requests for $150 billion in funding for state and local governments, and Democrats are opposed to a GOP request for a liability waiver for COVID-19-related lawsuits. Here's Senator McConnell earlier today during a press briefing.
So yep. On those next 2 weeks, I just want to clarify something you said earlier. You've been talking about the importance of the liability protection since July, I think. Mm-hmm. If that's not something that can be broadly agreed to in the next 2 weeks, would you put a COVID relief bill on the floor that does not have that in it?
Well, I'm sure you were carefully listening a while ago. I have a suggestion to make, which is that the two most contentious items be set aside. Liability protection, we all know, with all due respect to our colleagues on the other side, they are almost like a wholly owned subsidiary of the plaintiff's bar. So any kind of liability relief, they instinctively, like a Pavlovian response, object to. we have some very serious questions about the actual need of additional state and local assistance. So what I've suggested to them internally and suggest to you publicly, why don't we set aside the two obviously most contentious issues? We know we're going to be confronted with another request after the first of the year. We'll live to fight those another day and pass the things that we agree on.
And that was Senator Mitch McConnell earlier today speaking with reporters. Congressional leaders are working to finalize the details of a short-term coronavirus aid package, and a bipartisan group of lawmakers are pushing to add stimulus checks. Now here's Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer.
Now, Senator McConnell has put the jobs of firefighters, ambulance workers, sanitation officers, police officers in jeopardy. Every governor and mayor across the country has been fighting to keep these people working, and McConnell is pulling the rug out from under them. When a worker is laid off from a state or local government, it's no different than when a worker is laid off from a small business. They each have to feed their families, pay the rent or mortgage, and just have enough wherewithal, enough dollars to survive. The state and local funding provisions have broad bipartisan support from the National Governors Association and within the Senate. Many Republicans support state and local funding. State and local funding is bipartisan. Unlike the extreme corporate liability proposal Leader McConnell made, which has no Democratic support. Leader McConnell has refused to be part of the negotiations. Leader McConnell has refused to be part of the bipartisan negotiations, and now he's sabotaging good faith bipartisan negotiations because his partisan ideological effort is not getting a good reception. Senator McConnell is trying to pull the rug out from beneath the Gang of Eight. We believe they have been making good progress, and they ought to be allowed to move forward because they are the best hope for a bipartisan solution.
And that was Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer earlier today. Now, Majority Leader McConnell and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi have said they hope to include coronavirus relief in a year-end spending bill. And from the House side of the Capitol, here's Democratic Caucus Chair Hakeem Jeffries of New York speaking this morning with reporters over what the House Democrats want in a COVID-19 relief spending bill.
Would you like to see, would your caucus like to see direct payments, checks be part of this down payment that you're being negotiated now?
Well, the bipartisan framework that has been discussed in the Senate, along with Congressman Josh Gottheimer, is a foundation for a path forward. Several members of the House Democratic Caucus, as well as several Republican senators, have expressed an interest in ensuring that there are some form of direct payments in this package. The problem, of course, as it has always been, is Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Dr. No, along with President Trump, who's missing in action while the American people suffer. And so it remains to be seen what will take place. It is important that the framework does include housing assistance for everyday Americans, food insecurity assistance for everyday Americans, as well as a continuation of unemployment insurance benefits for everyday Americans. That is a solid foundation to build upon. We'll see what happens over the next few days.
And joining us now on Washington Today is Christina Marcos of The Hill publication. Ms. Marcos, a lot of money being debated up in Congress right now. Let's start with the COVID relief plan. Where are we?
Well, right now, senators are still trying to negotiate a bipartisan package. But progress is still slow moving, just as it has been since July. But lawmakers are under a lot of pressure within the next 10 days or so to try to get something out that can help Americans who are unemployed and need economic relief and in the height of the pandemic right now, as well as money that will help with vaccine distribution, which is going to be a major part of what eventually ends this pandemic.
So we're talking about $900 billion for this COVID-19 relief package, and now the Trump administration has announced it wants another $600 billion for direct relief to Americans. How did we get to this number? Pre-election, the number was a lot different.
Well, senators in of both parties, a so-called gang that's been working together over the last couple of weeks, they got down to this number as a way to reach sort of a compromise between Senate Republicans' proposal, which has been around $500 billion, and the Democrats' proposal, which originally was closer to $2 trillion. They went down to a little over $1 trillion. And so they're trying to reach some sort of middle ground there. But what this proposal has not included is another round of stimulus checks, like the ones that were in the March CARES Act. But that was one of the most popular provisions of that law. And so there are members in both parties who are calling for another round of these checks to help with Americans. However, the $600 proposal that the Trump administration is floating, reportedly, that's a lot less than what was in the March CARES Act with these payments of up to $1,200. So there could be some resistance to progressives who are calling for something much more generous.
So overall, the U.S. has put about $3 trillion plus into COVID relief plans. Does there seem to be an avenue for this most recent one to pass in the next week?
Lawmakers are looking at tying this to a spending bill to fund the government. Current funding expires this Friday, the 11th, and since it's unlikely they'll reach a deal on a spending bill to fund the government in time, they're likely going to kick it into next week. But because this is the train that's leaving the station before they depart for the holidays, they consider that the easiest vehicle to attach this long-stalled coronavirus relief.
So when it comes to general government spending, the Congress is looking at a one-week extension at current levels, correct?
That is correct, along with an extension of certain health programs.
And if that kicks in, then what's going to happen next week?
It's pretty much an annual holiday tradition on Capitol Hill, where there's late in the game scrambling to reach a deal on some must-pass legislation, and this year is no different. So it's very typical for Congress to set a deadline for funding the government around this time, around the 11th to the 15th, but inevitably there are some last-minute snags and they have to extend it for in the days closer to the actual holidays when lawmakers are itching to get out of town and the jet fumes start to make them move faster toward reaching a deal, and that's what they're likely aiming for within the next week.
So chances are that something will pass this week and then they'll consider it again next week.
They'll pass an extension of current funding this week to give themselves more time for the negotiations. So once we do get into next week and we're getting much closer to the holidays, that's going to build a lot more pressure on them to reach a deal. And the lawmakers themselves will personally be eager to get out of Washington to go home for the holidays. And so it's much more likely that we'll see them pass a bill sometime next week.
And the House is scheduled to vote on a week extension tomorrow.
That is correct. The House plans to vote tomorrow to extend current funding through the 18th, and it's unclear whether they'll stay in session because, given the coronavirus concerns among members themselves. But they'll certainly plan to be back here next week.
And just to be clear, the COVID-19 relief package would or would not be included in that vote tomorrow?
It would not be in tomorrow's vote. Tomorrow's vote is simply an extension of current funding to buy themselves time for another week so that we don't also have a government shutdown at the height of this pandemic.
Christina Marcos of The Hill, thanks for giving us the update.
Thanks for having me.
And you're listening to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. Now, according to The Washington Post, quote, President-elect Joe Biden's pick of Lloyd Austin to be Secretary of Defense is stirring unease in Congress, reflecting fears that putting a recently retired general in charge could further undermine the centuries-old principle of civilian control of the military. General Austin must get a congressional waiver of a requirement that a defense secretary be out of uniform at least 7 years before taking office. Mr. Austin retired in 2016 after 41 years in the Army and has never held a political position. Such a congressional waiver has been granted only twice, in 1950 for George Marshall and in 2017 for Jim Mattis, the retired Marine general who became President Donald Trump's first defense secretary. So, Benjamin Friedman of Defense Priorities, what do we know about Lloyd Austin?
Lloyd Austin is a 67-year-old retired four-star general from the Army. If he becomes Secretary of Defense, he'll be the first African-American Secretary of Defense. His career is the Army. He spent his entire professional career in this institution. He served in Afghanistan in a command position in Iraq twice, overseeing U.S. forces in Syria. So he's had a long experience and a more recent experience in U.S. wars in the Middle East.
Well, he's not necessarily a name that's known outside of defense circles. Is that correct?
Absolutely, yeah. He's not known other than for people who follow the government and the military closely. I mean, he was the commander of Central Command, which is a major post in the United States military, one that is very prominent, but not a person that the average American would know anything about.
What's his reputation in defense circles?
I think his reputation is as a competent professional who was promoted to four stars for good reason in the Army. I don't think he has a reputation that is out of the ordinary for a four-star general. That is, you know, James Mattis had this reputation as sort of a guy who could write and was known to make quips and sort of this warrior scholar. Maybe that was a bit overrated, but Austin, I think, is just known for someone who has been doing his job somewhat quietly for a long time.
So what has he been doing since 2016 when he retired from the Army?
I don't know every move that he's made, but I think the controversial aspect is he's on the board of a couple defense contractors, which, you know, causes some consternation in at least progressive circles, along with consternation about the fact that he's only been retired for 4 years. So he needs a change of law from Congress to become Secretary of Defense.
And what is that change of law?
Well, the law that established the Secretary of Defense long ago, I believe in 1947, established the 10-year waiting period after you were left active duty before you could become Secretary of Defense. They immediately made an exception for George Marshall in 1950. But since then, nobody got a waiver, if you want to call it that, until Mattis. And the law was changed so that it was 7 years instead of 10. But Austin only has four. So regardless, he needs Congress to do something. And it's a change of law. I mean, it's not sort of a simple waiver. That both houses have to pass law that says we, you know, are changing this just this one time only for this candidate.
So Benjamin Friedman, it would be difficult to find a qualified defense secretary who is not involved in the defense industry today. Is that a fair statement?
I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of people who have reached a point in their career. You know, several of the other candidates for Secretary of Defense had similar problems. Michelle Flournoy and Jay Johnson. But I think actually there are a lot of people out there who have substantial experience in government who don't serve on the boards of Raytheon or Lockheed Martin or something like that. For example, we've had a bunch of Secretary of Defenses in the past who were senators or congressmen. And those people, I think, have some of the best skills that would enable somebody to be Secretary of Defense, which is political skills. And they don't have this problem of a potential conflict of interest.
Was Lloyd Austin a surprise choice?
He was a surprise in the sense that up until, I don't know what it was, a week or two ago, his name wasn't one that you ever heard in these conversations about who Biden would pick if he was elected president, and then after he was elected. Yeah, it was surprising. It wasn't surprising yesterday because we've been hearing that he was a possibility for a week or two. But yeah, it's pretty surprising, largely because we are not accustomed to thinking of recently retired general officers as candidates for Secretary of Defense.
So a lot of the talk during this transition period has been about Michelle Flournoy. What happened there?
I don't know. A lot of people seem to think they know why Joe Biden didn't pick Michelle Flournoy as Secretary of Defense. And a lot of people seem to think that she was a shoo-in. And what I would say is that none of those people seem to have it from Joe Biden. So I think that what we can say for sure is that Joe Biden didn't want her to be a Secretary of Defense. We don't know exactly why. Maybe he didn't like having her candidacy sort of stuffed down his throat by all her legion of supporters in Washington. But for one reason or another, he didn't pick her. So I think there's been a lot of attempt to blame it on the progressive left as if they have that much sway over Biden. But it seems like something that had to do with Biden's experience in the Obama administration and that of his closest advisors. And of course, Flournoy was there too. So maybe there was some bad blood, but I really don't know.
Now, Benjamin Friedman, what's your background in military affairs and what is defense priorities?
Well, I study military affairs. I'm not a veteran. I haven't served in the military, but I'm a scholar of defense politics, defense policy. I've been writing about it for a while at other think tanks and this one. So Defense Priorities is a think tank that tries to advance a more realist and restrained foreign policy. We've been generally anti-war, although we're not pacifists, and we're in favor of a somewhat more modest approach to U.S. foreign policy and defense.
And previously, Benjamin Friedman served as a defense analyst at the Cato Institute. He's an adjunct professor at George Washington University's Elliott School of International Affairs, graduate of Dartmouth. Mr. Friedman, thanks for spending some minutes with us.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
And in more military news, the Army is punishing 14 leaders at Fort Hood in Texas, relieving some high-ranking officers of duty after a review of the killing of Specialist Vanessa Gillian. From earlier today at the Pentagon, here is Army Secretary Ryan McCarthy.
Over the course of 103 days, the panel surveyed 31,612 soldiers, interviewed 647 soldiers, and met with civic and elected leaders, local law enforcement leaders, and the local district attorneys. On November 9, the panel briefed the Army senior leaders and provided 9 findings and 70 recommendations. The findings of the committee identified major flaws with sexual harassment and assault response prevention program from implementation, reporting, and adjudication. Fundamental issues with Fort Hood Criminal Investigation Command field office activities that led to unaddressed problems on Fort Hood. And finally, a command climate at Fort Hood that was permissive of sexual harassment and sexual assault. Further, the committee made 70 recommendations to improve the following areas: overall SHARP program structure, Fort Hood criminal investigation field office command activities, Army missing soldier protocols, Fort Hood crime prevention and response activities, Army-wide command climate issues, and Fort Hood public affairs activities.
And that was Army Secretary Ryan McCarthy earlier today. Now, late this afternoon, the Supreme Court refused to hear the Trump allies' challenge to the Pennsylvania election. According to USA Today's Richard Wolf, quote, The Supreme Court refused Tuesday to stop Pennsylvania from certifying President-elect Joe Biden's victory in the state, despite allegations from allies of President Donald Trump that the expansion of mail-in voting was illegal. The action by the nation's highest court, which includes three justices named by President Trump, came as states across the country are locking in the results that will lead to next week's Electoral College vote. By their one-sentence denial, the justices left intact a ruling by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. That, again, is Richard Wolf writing in USA Today. And finally, today it was announced that retired Air Force Brigadier General Charles Chuck Yeager has died. He was 97 years old. In 1947, he was the first person to fly faster than the speed of sound when he exceeded Mach 1 in the experimental Bell X-1 rocket plane. He also served in World War II and received the Presidential Medal of Freedom from President Ronald Reagan. For his service in the military, he was awarded the Purple Heart, the Bronze Star, the Air Force Commendation Medal, the Silver Star, the Legion of Merit, the Distinguished Service Medal, the Distinguished Flying Cross, and the Air Medal. Now, here's a portion of an interview he did with West Virginia Public Broadcasting back in 2006 discussing his accomplishments.
The sound barrier was something that people feared, and you didn't fear it.
Well, that wasn't my job. Duty enters into it. Mm-hmm. You got a job to do, you do it, just like fighting a war. Whether you could or not, that didn't enter into the picture.
The sound barrier, in my mind, is sort of like the flat earth thing.
Yeah. You and I are different. I was flying. You weren't.
Yeah. My mother came in and told me Chuck Yeager broke the sound barrier.
Okay.
And all of a sudden, Chuck Yeager was in Pocatello, Idaho, where I was from, maybe the most important guy in my life for a long, long time. And I paid attention to what you did for a long, long time. But the sound barrier was like something important in, like, the exploration and adventure.
To me, the war was important. Mm-hmm. Everything that I did, it was my duty, it was all important. Sound barrier was just another program. I was working on 10 test programs when I was flying the X-1. Mm.
How many planes have you flown?
208 military types.
What haven't you done? What haven't you, that you'd like to do? What haven't you done that you'd like to do?
I don't have any desire. When I was doing all that stuff, it was my duty. It's just, you know, that's your duty.
If you could change anything in your life, would you change anything?
No, hell no.
It's been that good?
Well, no. That's number one, that's a stupid question. And number two, you can't change it, so why would you?
And Chuck Yeager flew for more than 60 years, including piloting an F-15 to near 1,000 miles per hour at Edwards Air Force Base in October 2002 at age 79. His exploits were told in Tom Wolfe's book, The Right Stuff, and in the 1983 movie it inspired. Well, that's it for Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. If you've missed any of this program, you can find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the rest of your evening.
C-SPAN's Washington Journal. Every day we're taking your calls live, on the air, on the news of the day, and we'll discuss policy issues that impact you. Coming up Wednesday morning, Ohio Democratic Congressman Tim Ryan discusses the future of the Democratic Party and congressional news of the day, including the looming government funding deadline and efforts to forge a compromise on COVID-19 relief legislation. Then Alabama Republican Congressman Mo Brooks talks about his plan to challenge the Electoral College vote tally when Congress officially certifies the results of the presidential election on January 6th. And Georgetown University Medical Center's Dr. Jesse Goodman, former chief scientist at the FDA, discusses the COVID-19 vaccine approval process. Watch C-SPAN's Washington Journal, live at 7 Eastern Wednesday morning. Be sure to join the discussion with your phone calls, Facebook comments, text messages, and tweets.